This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about 2 fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
To me, it's very personal. So, like, when something is personal, whether it's writing or acting or singing or cooking or whatever it is that you do, like, it's all of you. So, like, how do you extrapolate those pieces from each other? Like, you know, like you're saying, like, speak to your demographic. Like, which demographic am I supposed to speak to?
That is Oakland-based chef Pretty Mystery.
Going back to the ricotta gnocchi, I mean, we got into this really long discussion about the shape of the spoon. Like, there's a very specific shape that when you have your finger come off of that spoon, how it should be shaped so it goes into the water, so that the water has to be simmering at the right level for it to actually, when it hits the water, for the simmering water to actually kind of tumble the ricotta like gnocchi.
Yeah.
And so she knew if there was some times where people were like, oh my God, where is the spoon? You know, and we would have to be like, oh, well, no one can find it. We got to use this other spoon. And
yeah.
Like, let's see. And she's like, what happened to these?
And that is Brandon Jew of Mr. Jew's in San Francisco, California, part of a panel of chefs remembering Chef Judy Rogers on a special live episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs recorded at San Francisco Cooking School. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, and I'm here with a special guest. We've been doing this a lot. Our special guest is Jody Liano. What do you like to be called? You say founder.
Founder.
Yeah. Founder. But you're also the owner.
I am, but that's I'm like not a, crazy that's about
a,
that word.
That's a modest way of saying owner.
I guess so.
Okay. Of San Francisco Cooking School. This is your 12th year?
No, seven.
Seven, I'm yeah. sorry. This yeah, is your yeah. seventh year. I don't know why I had that number in my
Feels
head.
Feels like 12 sometimes.
There was someone last night on stage who'd been 12 years somewhere. Maybe it was Nate and Zuni Cafe.
That sounds about right.
I think
about
that's right. about right. So, and you are just, we're sitting here in the little conference, it's not really a room, the conference nook. At upstairs where the offices are at the school, and you have just finished the first, can we say first annual? Do we
I
believe
so.
There will be a second one?
I do believe there will be
okay,
a second
one. Okay, so the inaugural and first annual Food Media Lab, and this was a three-day, what do we call it? And the conference is wrong. It was like a pop-up school.
Yeah.
It was a pop-up school within your school. It was for people who want to be in food media, maybe who are in food media but not getting where they want to be, and you and John Birdsall and Andrea Nguyen brought together a pretty. I mean, I'm not including myself in this, but I mean, I was on the roster, but it was like a heavy hitter roster of mostly West Coast based journalists, podcasters, media figures. To basically impart knowledge for 3 days. And then in the in-betweens, lunches and breakfast and coffee breaks, it was a very, networking sounds so mercenary, but it was supposed to be that. It was a chance for people to ask us a lot of questions. It was, if I understand it right, there was a contact sheet given out, or there's going to be one emailed to everyone who participated of the speaker's information. So they're encouraged to reach out to speakers like me with advice and, you know, seeking advice and whatnot. It's right. I'm summarizing it right.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of opportunities for people to be talked to as they're learning how to do new things.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to build something where it was more collaborative, where people really felt like they were talking with each other, that there were workshops and not just panels, that they got their hands in things, they got their voice in things.
Yes.
And that really ended up being the case by the end of today.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, the whole thing, I think I was actually probably here more than most other speakers. I mean, I was here almost all of day one. I was here all of day two, and I came here for the very tail end of day three. Most people, as you pointed out to me, live here, so they actually were going to their offices, and I was like on the road. So, but it was really something to see. And for me, Birdsall made a comment the other day. I said, you know, well, I'm always happy to do stuff like this because when I started, everybody was so mean to me. And he said, well, you're from New York. You know, so maybe it is just nicer out here.
I don't think so. John originally had made a comment about how isolating it can be to come up in this business and not have your people.
Yeah.
And if you can give someone the advantage of helping them find those people at the beginning of their career, it's inspiring, it's motivating, it's educational.
It might make the difference whether or not you stick it out.
Totally.
Because writing's already lonely. You know, I mean, or everything media related, it is lonely.
Yeah.
And it's usually job to job, and everyone's fighting for the same scraps, and very few people. I mean, you know, one of the first things that I think it was his keynote address where he said, don't come into this business thinking you're going to be like the next Ruth Reichel. You know?
Right.
I mean, Ruth became what Ruth was. There had never been anyone before her who had that spot.
Right.
Or Gail Green, or these people we think of who kind of invented what we all do right now.
Right.
You know? So, that said, I still think I'm going to write a really huge book one day. I mean, it's going to make... I still have that fantasy. I also have to say, Jody, can I ask, did I seem well-rested while I was here?
You did. For someone that is generally on East Coast time.
East Coast time.
And I know
he
did not sleep well before he got here.
I have to just acknowledge, I was staying at the Hotel Carlton, which is half a mile by foot, I think, roughly, give or take.
Super central.
It was like a nice 10-minute walk every morning. I have to be honest, they extended me a media rate, which not a lot of hotels do anymore. It used to be more common, but to my new pal, Haley, in the sales department there, thank you for helping out a poor scribe like myself. I really appreciated it, and I was very cozy there, so thank you for that. Okay, so I taught podcasting, and on night two of the conference, we did a live podcasting event here. It was only the second one I had done. You and I produced it together. We worked together on inviting people. So the headliner was Priti Mistry. And for anyone who's mispronounced her name, that is the pronunciation. I have it straight from her. Priti Mistry, as like mystery novel, or she said to me, like Nancy Drew. So help me introduce her, because this was, I thought, a pretty great segment. She's an Oakland-based chef. She's closed two restaurants in the last little bit of time. She's without a restaurant at the moment. She's
an author.
She's an author of the Juhu Beach Club cookbook, which is half a memoir, really.
And I think she's twice been nominated for a Beard Award.
Okay.
She spent the early part of her career working on film festivals in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And has grown into an iconic, I would say, for lack of a better word, maybe food and social activist.
Activist, advocate.
Oakland.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah, somewhere in that realm of advocate, activist, or a hyphenate of the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to say, first of all, for anyone who's seen her, I still have my accounts. I don't go on Twitter much, but I guess she even said to me, and John Birdsall said to me, her Twitter persona is very in your face, very aggressive, very angry, very outspoken. And, you know, we were up in what was the sort of, you know, improvised green room here. before the show, and she came up, and she was very jovial, and she's very kind of animated.
She's also very earnest. I feel like she wears her heart on her sleeve, which you might not expect if you hadn't met her in person.
And when we were standing up there, she said to me, you know, she goes, I'm not angry. I'm not angry. Do I seem angry? And I'm like, you seem completely not angry to an extent that I'm shocked by, because having read as much about you as I did getting ready to talk to you, there's no hard edge to her at all. Not that there'd be a problem if there was. And when you hear her talk about some of the issues we talk about, you kind of feel like maybe there should be, or maybe there is one, but it's like, you know, overgrown with this like pleasantness, you know, that she exudes.
And it happens. You see her eyes light up when you talk about causes that are close to her heart.
Totally.
So rather than coming at it from an angry perspective, she comes at it from how she can do good.
Yes.
And I think it's lovely to see and hear.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought she was great. She came with her wife, Anne, who I really liked. And it was the first thing we did in the show. It was a two-part show. The second part was a tribute to Judy Rogers, which we'll introduce during the mid-show break. Do I need to say anything else? I don't know if I do.
I don't think so. Okay. I think the great thing about last night was that you had taught about podcasting during the day.
Yeah.
And so many of the students from the Food Media Lab came.
Yes, that was included in the ticket.
Right. Yeah. And they were able to see it come to life. And they came back today, having been through that whole cycle. And it was this revelatory moment that so many people had.
They were talking about this morning.
Yes.
I couldn't get here. I was planning to be here, like I said. I was going to be here for the full ride. And I woke, you know, 2 days out of touch with people. And this morning, like everything, all the chickens came home to roost. And I could not get out of my hotel room to save my life.
People love that. They really loved.
It brought the day full circle.
Bringing everything full circle.
Yeah.
Seeing all the advice you had given in action.
Mm-hmm.
I think people felt like there's something you turn on as an interviewer in a very positive way, and how that actually happens to come across as authentic as you typically do. They loved it. They loved
That's
it.
That's great.
It was inspiring to people to it come full circle.
I'm so sorry I wasn't here this morning.
I'm glad we did that.
It would have done wonders for my self-esteem. Okay. Well, we're going to talk more about the school and some other things during the mid-show break. But with that, I'm now going to kick it over to my live interview from the San Francisco Cooking School and the Food Media Lab with Chef Priti Mistry. Here you go. Thank you, Jody. Hi, everybody. I'm not sure I deserved all that. A little of that.
You deserve it. Just take it.
You would take it,
take
right?
Take it in.
Take it
in. Yeah, absorb it.
Thank you for being here, everybody. Can I just see a show of hands? How many people were here for the lab today? Oh, pretty good amount. Great. You know, on the show, if you listen to it, you know, I usually do intros after the fact as part of the introduction of the show. But just by way of introduction, Priti Mistry, Oakland-based chef. Have any of you been to either of her restaurants that are sadly no longer extant? Okay,
yeah,
quite
a few people.
So Juhu Beach Club and Navi Kitchen. Has been, of course, on Top Chef.
Which was literally a decade ago.
Top Chef.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 10 years.
Should I not have mentioned it?
No, I'm just saying.
Okay.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very politically active, very politically forward, very unshy in your opinions, I would say. It's great to meet you. And with that, please welcome Priti Mistry.
Thank you.
So, here's the first thing I wanted to ask you, because this is something that always fascinates me. It's a moment in a chef's life. I think it is inevitable when a chef is without a restaurant.
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's weird, right?
It's
so
really weird.
Can you talk about what this moment in your life, it's not the first time you've been there,
right.
What this moment in your life is like for you? Because I think everyone experiences it a little differently.
I mean, I think that first and foremost, it's like so much of your identity becomes the restaurant, especially when you have something that's really like, you know, Juhu and Navi were both very much like a passion. And it was, you know, as opposed to restaurants that I was the chef of in the past working for other people, it was really like my soul.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's hard to even think about Juhu as like separate from me as a human. So there was a lot of challenges, a lot of, you know, tears and moments of frustration and confusion. But I've been here before, as you were saying, And I think that it's really, in some ways, important, like, especially as we're in this time where we're sort of, like, looking at the way that, like, these celebrity chef egos and the way that we put chefs on a pedestal in this way. I just think that, like, having this opportunity to kind of disengage from that identity and just be like, okay, I'm just me and that's okay, and not sort of, like, kind of release the ego. I feel like that's a good exercise for people in whatever profession. But I think that, you know, ultimately the most challenging part for me is just that I'm like a person who has like a lot of energy. Like the reason I started cooking was because I like, I worked in an office after college and I would literally like, this was back when fax machines existed. So, and there was like one at the end of the hallway and I would literally like run down the hall and put something in the fax machine and stand in front of the fax machine and like bounce up and down and just jump up and down. And then the fax would come through and I would like grab it and like run back to my office and like stand at my desk. And, you know, it was like, so I think just that part of me that like really like needs to move my body, be around a lot of people and like just have a million things going on is like what, you know, for some people that's overwhelming. And for like someone like myself, it's really like exciting and motivating. And like, that's what gets me going is all of that stuff happening at once. So I think that like kind of, and the flip side of that is I'm a total procrastinator. Like, so the fact that I have all this time in the world to like write that one article, is like, okay, like I'm just going to dick around for hours doing things I don't need to do. I'm most successful when I literally have a 1,000-pound gorilla chasing me. Like, that's when I'm my best.
You do your best work under pressure.
Yeah.
You like that?
Yes.
Do you, you just described this energy, the thing in the office, running up and down the halls, your eyes are going wide as I say this. Okay, so the restaurants replaced, or filled that need for you in their own way. Do you replace it with anything at a time like this? A lot of chefs I've spoken to who are between restaurants, they talk about the rhythm of the day. And it's just like, it's weird for them to be home for dinner, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes their spouse and families find it, maybe that they didn't mind when they weren't there for dinner. I say this as your spouse is here.
Yes, but, my wife is here in the audience.
But the rhythm of the day and whether or not you've replaced what the kitchen gives you with anything on a temporary basis. Like, are you working out more?
A lot of hiking.
Okay.
Which I will thank my wife as well as part of that. It's just like forcing me to do that. So, I mean, and I'm not the only chef. There's been a lot of chefs I've talked to when they're like between restaurants. They're like, yeah, I did a lot of hiking. And I'm like, yeah, lots of nature, lots of hiking. Other than that, I'm kind of crappy at it. I'm really crappy at it. Like, I'll totally be in my PJs until like 11:30 noon. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I should probably like take a shower.
Right. Yeah. Well, welcome to the writer's life.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I know that like my goal is to have another restaurant eventually. And therefore, like, I know that a different day is going to come when I'm going to have a lot more responsibility. So, and just, I won't have this kind of time. So like part of me, at least the first like 6 months, I kind of reveled in it a little bit. Like, I deserve this. Like, I could just hang out. Like, I'm going to go have fancy lunch with friends on a Wednesday. But I think at some point, like, I'm starting to, like, get to that point where... So I closed Juhu at the beginning of January, and I closed Navi at the end of June. So the anniversary of that is coming up, and then, you know, the various weeks that it takes to actually extrapolate yourself from a business. So, yeah, I think I'm starting to get to the point where I'm, like, itching and ready to, like, have more routine in my life, but I'm really crappy at it. Like, I just do whatever.
Right.
And then stuff like this, just... I'm like, oh, right, I have to, like, be somewhere.
did you almost blank on it?
No. Not totally, but I mean, but it is like a little bit, like, you know, it's sort of like, I was just in Charleston at this conference.
Yeah.
Jody was there as well. It was a women chef and restaurateur conference. So it's things like that where it's like other chefs are there and they're like barely getting out of their restaurant. They had a million things to do. They're like getting text messages every 20 minutes about, you know, this person didn't show up in this. And I'm just like, hey, what's up, everybody?
Right.
Where do you guys want to go for lunch?
Right.
So that part feels good.
Sure. Do you, you know, something that was really, I was really interested to speak to you about was, you know, I very often on this show will try to avoid asking people to speak for their demographic, right? Unless it comes up. There are certain people who want to,
yeah.
right? They want to do that. Amanda Cohen's a friend of mine. She was mm-hmm. the second guest ever.
Fantastic chef.
And happy to talk issues, happy to talk specifically women's issues, mm-hmm. right? I have had people, I can't even say who because they asked me not to, who I get ready to start an interview and they'll say, can we not do the women questions? I don't mm-hmm. want to do the women questions.
Yeah.
You know? I have heard you say in interviews,
dun, dun, dun.
Well, no, not that it was, what you thought it was silly to pretend otherwise.
Yeah.
Right? Like I always say, my little catchphrase is nobody wants to be a woman chef or a gay chef
Why?
Or a queer chef. Well, well... This is the question.
Right.
Right? But I've heard you say even like, you know, why pretend you're not an Indian chef? Like, that's absurd.
Right. That's who I am. It makes me who I
yes,
am.
Yes. But what part do you, can you I... just expand on your own philosophy about this?
I mean, I think that cooking is really personal.
Yeah.
I think it's an expression. I think, you know, for a really long time, I shied away from the word artist because I'm like, no, I have a craft. I'm not an artist.
Yeah.
Maybe I am. I don't know. But I think that to me, it's very personal. So like when something is personal, whether it's writing or acting or singing or cooking or whatever it is that you do, like it's all of you. So like, how do you extrapolate those pieces from each other? Like, you know, like you're saying, like, speak to your demographic, like which demographic am I supposed to speak to? Like, you know, I mean, I love Amanda. I got nothing against her, but she's a straight cis white woman. So she's speaking to being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes her a marginalized person. But that's the one difference.
Right.
Well, so like, where do I start?
No, I get that.
For me, it's like, it's all of who you are. Like, I feel, I don't go in the kitchen and I'm like, I'm not a woman now. I'm just a chef. Like, I am everything I am at all times. Like, it's like asking if, you know, people are like, is your food more California? You know, whatever. People ask crazy questions. Like, do you identify as Indian or American? It's like, I'm both. Like, how could you not be those two things? Like, so how do you say, like, that being a woman or being queer or being a person of color or being a person who has a higher level of education as opposed to somebody else or has had certain life experiences, like all of that is a part of your expression. Like I'm cooking food that's like my personal expression.
No,
so all of those pieces are like, I'm not angry with you. It's okay.
No. But I was going to make a distinction.
Yeah.
I think when people, certainly when I say this.
Not yet.
No, give it time. No, but when I have said that and when I've had conversations with people about this, I think those are all things that you are proud of. Those mm-hmm. are all things that you put out there. Those mm-hmm. are all things that for you are like twirled up in, that's your identity, right? That's
right.
Who you are. I think what people don't like is when someone other than them,
mm-hmm.
somebody who doesn't fall into all these, you know, like a cisgendered white middle-aged guy, right, mm-hmm. says, oh, you know, the Indian chef so-and-so, or when they give an award and it's best, you know, the 50 best still gives
well, that's a bullshit. Best.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
So there's a difference.
I think it's one thing when you put it out into the world, as this is who I am, and it's another thing when people try to put you in a cubbyhole or say you get this spot because you are fall into one of you. Tick some of these boxes for them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean,
I think that's a very different thing.
So there's a lot of people that are like, I don't want to be seen as a woman chef. I just want to be a chef. And it's like, great, you are, but you are still a woman. Like, why are you not like proud of that? Like, it's not a bad thing or a good thing. There's no value judgment placed on it unless you want to place a value judgment on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, it's like, you are like, in fact, like, fuck, that makes you better. I don't know. Like, I feel like whatever you do that's part of you, and like, I get this whole, like, yes, the Women Chef Award is total BS because we all do the same job. Like, there's no reason why there should be a separate award. To me, it's just like an excuse for having a list that is male dominated. It's
right.
Like, oh, we're going to like do this thing over here, which just is like some sexism and BS, right? But like, To say, oh, I just want to be known as a chef, not a woman chef. Well, yeah, that is like Yes, of course. We all want to be seen and respected as chefs for our profession, period. But guess what? Like, I got some bells and whistles that I'm actually proud of. I'm not, like, trying to deny them. It makes me who I am. It makes me a better chef. It makes me, like, have... the, you know, one of the things... I was on a panel with John Birdsall a couple years ago around Pride, which we are in Pride Month. Yay, corporate America is rainbow-colored. And we were talking about the idea of queer food. Like, what is that? And, you know, one of the things I thought about is how, like, as a queer person, even though I grew up, I'm a person of Indian origin, like, I always grew up feeling different than the rest of my family. I didn't know why or what that was about when I was seven or whatever, mm-hmm. but I always felt different, and I feel like that allowed me, like, when I started cooking Indian cuisine, to feel like there's no rules. Because, you know, I wasn't, like, fitting into all these other aspects where then it was like, well, then you have to cook this way. Like, I'm not a straight woman. I didn't marry some Indian guy. We don't, like, I don't know. I didn't grow up cooking with my mother. Like, I have two older sisters. They both, you know, I thought of cooking as, like, women's work that my mom would make us do. And I was like, I'm going to go play video games. And so for me, it's like, when I started cooking Indian food, I feel like I was like, okay, well, there's no set rules of how I go about this. And I think that a lot of that has to do with my gender and, like, sexual orientation of just, like, feeling already outside. So, like, it's not like I have to, like...
conform.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I'm already so outside of any sort of conforming that, like, whatever. Just fucking do whatever. And, like, there's no rules. So I think that, like, there's a million... You know, and I think about, like, Elizabeth Faulkner and, like, the stuff that she did when she started, like, doing all this modern stuff. Like, not a lot of pastry chefs were doing that. Like, I remember being at a dinner... some, like, chef share of strength kind of dinner, and she was doing one of the courses, and there was a pastry chef who I won't name, but, you know, he was a lovely man, friend of mine, and probably at least, like, 20 years my senior, and he's a very renowned pastry chef, and it just was like, what the fuck is this? Like, he was so offended by this plate, because it was like, you know, this was probably, like, 15 years ago, or mm-hmm. at least, like, 12, and it was like, you know, this tube of, like, some ganache and, like, some torn pieces of cake and this thing and that thing and whatever, which all of us are like, yeah, that's, like, pretty normal in, like, a fine dining restaurant right now. But 12, you know, he comes from the, like, perfect tartare that's, like, you know, glaceed and just, like, every little fruit is perfectly on there, and that's, like, what he thinks of as, like, real pastry. And to me, I feel like that was, like, her queering pastry.
Mm-hmm.
Because for her, there were no rules. And I think that that's, like, that's part of a person's identity. Like, whatever it is, like, it informs what you create.
I love that. So, you just sort of alluded to the fine dining mindset, yeah. how sort of entrenched it is. Mm-hmm. I won't ask you about the whole New York Times interview, blah, blah, blah. But
thanks.
But talking around, if you don't know what I mean, you can Google it. But talking around that, right... You yourself went through a bit of an evolution in your attitude toward that type of food.
Yeah.
From adoration,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Reverence, to a real sort of questioning, I guess, of it. Or of its, intractability? Or its...
I mean, I think that the biggest thing for me was just my experience both working in it and also dining in it,
mm-hmm.
and realizing that as enamored as I was with this thing, that they didn't make this thing for people like me.
What do you mean by that? From the dining side.
My wife and I are two women. I am non-binary. I'm a brown person. We go to fancy restaurants and people treat us like shit. Period. I mean, there's not really any other way around it, yeah. you know, I mean, and so you get to this point where you're like, okay, here I am, or like halfway through, they like notice me and then everything changes and it's like, well, that's fucked up. Like, why wouldn't you just treat two people that look like us no matter what, like, oh, so now that I'm in the industry and you recognize me, like, now you're going to treat me differently, but like, but what about my friends and other people in my community that are not chefs or they're school teachers or mm-hmm. what have you? Like, they're, you know, so to me, I feel like there's something incredibly disingenuous about, like, you know, I mean, Korsha Wilson just wrote an interesting piece recently about A Critic for All Seasons.
Yeah,
Korsha Wilson's
piece.
African-American woman who is a food critic and was just talking about this. thing of like all of these all of these food critics, it's mostly white men, and the way they get, first of all, like they're noticeable, like obviously people have photos and whatever, but then secondly, like they're used to being treated really well. I idolize these places, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm so excited to go there, like we're so excited, we get all dressed up and we've been talking about it for 2 or 3 weeks and it's some special occasion and whatever, and we get there and we're treated poorly. Like I remember, like on my 35th birthday, so that was a while ago, I'm older than I look, and I won't name the restaurant, but it was not in San Francisco, we were outside of the country, and we were super excited, this restaurant was on the 50 best list, and we get all dressed up, we go to this dinner. And they were literally like so sort of brushing us off that it was just two of us, and they they're going to pour a sauce in front of you. They were about to pour the sauce when I was in the bathroom. Like there's only two diners and this restaurant is on the 50 best. Like where would that from a service perspective ever be allowed? And I just remember like halfway through the meal, just looking at my wife and being like, why do we do this? Like, why do we get all dressed up with all these expectations just to be treated like crap? And not to mention, like, half the 10 courses, I feel like I could probably do better. Like, the first three were like,
right.
And then you're like, okay, this is kind of, like, played out.
Right. And your stuff would probably have a little more behind it. It would have a little more meaning.
Yeah,
than a lot
it just
of that
feels
food.
Like yeah. It starts to feel phoned in. Yeah. So from that perspective, clinical. I just feel like, I've had so many, like when I think about the most amazing dining experiences that I've had, as much as like as a young person, I was like super enamored with everything fine dining and wine and service and this thing and that thing and all of that. I just became very disillusioned with at the end of the day, it's just like, entertainment for the 1%. Mm-hmm. And that started to feel really disingenuous to me in terms of like some of my deeper feelings about food and community and what food really means, and the way that it's like inspired my life doesn't feel like those types of environments really speak to that.
So I'm not asking you to do it, but I am struck that you chose not to name the restaurant just now.
Oh, because I name names. Is that what you mean?
The question I was going to have is that would you have made a different decision 5 years ago? Is that something that
Do
you feel like it's not
restaurant?
Worth the headache of naming it because of what might come your way?
I think it's important to name the names of either chefs or restaurants that have done things that are not so savory or like what have you, if it's productive. Like I don't mm-hmm. think there's anything, the chef of this restaurant, I don't think is necessarily a bad person. Like I don't think that there's anything going, it's just like, yeah, there was that, there we were, these two little women. Yeah. And then there's that table of like eight business guys with their expense accounts, and they're being showered with attention, and we're just like being forgotten in the corner. And it's like, it's so commonplace in our industry mm-hmm. that people act that way, that, I mean, servers and, et cetera, act that way, that it's not worth like saying. Like, it's more like, I'm not trying to make enemies, but I do think it's important to point things out when it's like something
productive.
that makes sense, it's productive.
Okay, thank you for that. But it is stunning to me, because I assume when you talk about these restaurants where mm-hmm. you two have received this treatment, you live in California.
Mm-hmm.
These places I'm sure are in California, New York, Chicago.
Some of them have women chefs.
Right.
At the helm.
It's 2019, and in those cities, you would think, or at least I would. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have to recalibrate every 3 years? Is it not at all surprising to you that this still happens? This is a little surprising to me, and those restaurants in these cities we're talking about. You know what Dan Savage calls the urban archipelago, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, it seems very, it's almost unfathomable to me that that's still the case. Now, I'm not doubting you at all, but that is stunning to me. And I know a lot of people work at these places
who
don't have those attitudes personally.
Stunning. Yeah. Of course it's shocking. But it's just like, that's just reality.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, I don't know. It's just how it is. I know this thing. And, I find myself like, because like I personally like being that I'm sort of, as my friends and I call it, semi-famous. A lot of places I go, people know who I am. And so they treat me very nicely. And that's lovely. And I still experience it.
Right.
Or, I mean, my favorite is always the semi-famous part where, like, somebody treats me crappy and I'm like, they're going to find out later who I really am. I was right. just really rude or dismissive,
right.
too.
Right.
But, I mean, it's no different than just our world. I think it's very just indicative of, like, our world, right? So our society, like, whether it's obvious racism or sexism or it's just basic strata of our society and how people are treated and microaggressions and how the assumptions that people make about, you know, servers making assumptions about who's going to be a good tipper or a bad tipper, like, oh, who knows what they're talking about when they talk about wine or service. Oh, you know, I mean, this is what servers do in most restaurants is they like assess a table, right?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, you know, this is your, like, you know, big night out. These people don't know shit about food.
Yes.
Like, they don't know anything about wine. I'm going to try to upsell them on this thing or that. You know, whatever. Whatever it is, like, there's only so much attention you can give. So you're going to, like, shaft that table because these, you know, people are, you know, regulars or all of those types of things just, like, all, like that exist in our larger society of how certain people are respected in ways that other people are not,
mm-hmm.
play out in a restaurant environment unless you do something intentionally to talk to your staff about how they treat everyone.
Yeah. Shifting gears dramatically, yeah. Can you alluded to a little bit the way your style sort of evolved or your attitude towards mm-hmm. food, right? Can you just tell us what are some moments when you think back to growing, you know, when you were younger, not probably growing up, but when you were a young adult,
mm-hmm.
when you started playing around with food a little bit, when you mm-hmm. started breaking some of those rules, what are some things you look back on as sort of signposts along the way of your evolution as a chef? Well, big smile.
So
what are some things that where you were like, that's who I am. That's where I'm going.
So before I went to culinary school, I was still working in queer film. So for the Frameline that's in San Francisco, the Lesbian Gay Film Festival. And 1999, 2000, New Year's Eve, Y2K. Everyone was worried the world was going to end.
Oh, right.
Right?
I
remember
about that?
Yeah.
It We're was all filling like, our bathtubs with water.
Yeah, it was
water.
Like the yeah. end of time.
Yeah, backing up our computers. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really happening in 12 years. but yeah, my wife and I, was my girlfriend at the time. We had a 10 courses to the millennium dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I cooked these 10 courses. It took forever. We had this tiny little one-bedroom apartment with, like, beige, like, wall-to-wall carpet. And we, like, I was like, we need to transform the place. And we, like, moved the sofa into the dining room and the dining room into the living room or whatever. And we had, like, all of these, like, I think I had, like, some, like, roasted eggplant with, like, edible flowers and shit and fondue to start and end because fondue. And we had, like, I think there were, like, 7 or 8 people there, and we had a bottle of sparkling wine for every single person to open. So at whatever point that it was, like, that person's turn, they awesome. Got to, like, open a bottle and, like, say something and then go around. Oh, we had corsages and boutonniere. It was also, like, gay prom at the same time.
That's so funny.
It was, like, we're all going to die, Y2K, 10 courses, and gay prom.
Can I just interject? I just went to the Inn at Little Washington for the first time,
uh-huh.
and when you walk into the dining room, they give all the gentlemen boutonnieres.
It was kind of awesome because I never had a boutonniere
yeah.
as in high school.
Right.
I went to prom with like a gay guy and his boyfriend and my girlfriend.
Okay.
And I wore a dress. Yeah.
Do you regret that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we got to relive it in our early 20s. And I got to wear a tie and a boutonniere, and it was awesome.
So the meal. So this was, how long did you spend planning something like that? Was it improvisational? Did you have the notion and then just kind of go for it day of? Or was this like a
no,
whole week
No, I mean, I think we
production?
Probably like prepped for like three. My wife's like, don't look at me. it's all you. yeah, I think we probably talked about it for like a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we like, you know, 3 or 4 days. Like, we had no space. It was this tiny little kitchen. So we were like, I remember we learned that my cat loves arugula because we had so many lettuces that we had to, like, you know, stretch them all, like, to dry out on the dining table in the middle of the apartment because there was, like, this much counter space.
Mm-hmm.
And my cat was eating the arugula. We were like, wow. Chilito likes arugula. So yeah, it was a process. It was a long process, and I was very adamant that it needed to have, like, you know, these dramatic kind of moments and yeah. different, you know.
And what did you
I can't remember else.
What did you take away from it, though? What was your takeaway from that?
I still like, you know, people become distant, people break up, they move to other cities, all these things happen, and there's, you know, still like friends who maybe I was closer to at that time, but I'm not that close with now, who will still be like, I remember that 10 courses to the millennium dinner that was like so amazing. So I think just like the fact that it really like all of our friends that were there, like really it like meant something to them, and they still
you
remember
made a memory.
It like 20 years later, it's like feels good.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned you made a passing reference to the art craft thing earlier, right? And people who listen to this show know that this has been an ongoing dialogue. This comes up periodically with chefs all across from different countries, different generations. I think most chefs I know lean toward craft.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are artistic sort of notions around it. Like there's, mm-hmm. you know, it is self-expression. That's an artistic notion.
Right.
But you do have to make something that people can eat. I mean, not everyone does that, but that is sort of the idea. But, you know,
it would be helpful.
There is this thing. There is this thing to me where, that it, to me exists between the two, and I just would love your reaction to this, which is what you just said, which is, you know, craft is something that's probably going to last, mm-hmm. right? Craftsmanship, right? Mm-hmm. You make something, you make a cabinet, you make whatever. Okay. Art is something that in many ways usually will last unless it's performance art or some kind of installation right. or yeah. something, right? But a meal, there is this thing about it that to me exists between those two things, right? Mm. Or outside of them, which goes beyond them, which is that on any given night, even in a restaurant, there's the food, there's the people who serve it, there's the people who eat it, and cooked it, right? Mm. And the food itself, which is gone at the end of the night, right? And to me, the fact that those people are the only ones who have shared that evening, right? And the product of that evening, the experience of that evening, takes it further. I'm not trying to be precious, but that's kind of what you were saying. But this has been kind of the... Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like the gestalt, right? It's
yeah.
like this sort of like everything coming together in this way. Like I'm like, you know, when Jew was open, I would be like super manic about like a lot of crazy, like detailed about things. Like once we were in Hong Kong and I like woke up on Sunday morning and like looked at the cameras and started texting my servers because the lights were too bright. And
oh,
they were like,
you were looking at
they
the,
were like, go, you're on, yeah, because it was Saturday
you had an
night.
App where you could look at your
yeah,
restaurant.
The, yeah, yeah, and I was like Saturday night in the restaurant and I wake up Sunday morning in Hong Kong and I'm like, let me see what's going on. Like, how busy is it? And I'm like, oh, look at those. So I start texting. I'm like, you guys, the lights are way too bright. And they're like, would you please just enjoy your vacation, big brother, and like leave us alone? I'm like, yeah, I will as soon as you turn the lights down.
Right. Yeah.
But to me, and when I would expo, I always like, you know, we have one of those Sonos systems. I would DJ. Like, it was totally, like, really important to me. Like, and I remember there'd be certain people, like, I'd be gone for, like, in the last 2 years. Like, I wouldn't be there, like, every single night. And then I'd be, like, back on a Saturday night, for, you know, and people would start to get used to, like, changing the music themselves. And I'd be like, excuse me, did somebody tell them? Like, I'm DJing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and they'd be like, well, your friends like this song. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not time for that song yet.
Right.
It's 7:15. Like, 9:15. Then we'll be ready for Lil Wayne. We're not ready for Lil Wayne right now. We're still in, like, I don't know, like the Bee Gees. So to me, like, just, it, but to me, it was like very important because it's about, like, it wasn't just like what I want to listen to at all. I mean, that's part of it. It's my taste and whatever, but it's also like I'm paying attention to the vibe in the room. Like, is it, you know, is it a dark at 5:15 because it's, you know, November and it's chilly out, or is it like a beautiful sunny day and like what do we feel like, what is the vibe and energy and the menu and all of those things feel like? Like, I'm gonna change the music to fit that.
Mm-hmm.
And because to me, like, all of those parts of it, you know, just like the dishware or the, you know, the artwork or everything is part of the experience.
It's a full sensory
right.
immersion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So can you, I'm struck talking to you. We never met before tonight.
No. And we refused to talk to each other before this.
Well, we'd made a decision not to talk to each other before this.
Yeah.
Yeah. We thought it'd be better.
I refuse.
Okay, so you just made the point I was about to make, which is you are a performer and a half, right? You were very performative in how you talk. Your gestures, your facial expressions, forgive me if I missed this. And you asked me if I did research before.
Oh, yeah.
So forgive me if I missed this. But, you know, I've seen a million interviews where you're like, when you were a kid, it was, you know, video games and this and that. What about performance? Did you do...
No one's ever asked me
that
before.
Was there theater in your childhood?
Good.
Oh, thank you.
I did do a certain amount of theater, and I also did a lot of public speaking. So,
what kind of stuff?
Here's a pretty good one.
What's your first memory of doing it?
Does anyone here know the epic Hindu tale Ramayana? I've got a couple people
one,
here.
One, two.
I was the golden deer. That means nothing
to
all the room.
Yeah.
The golden deer is like, so Ram, who's like a god, he like gets fooled by this golden deer that's like so beautiful and follows it into the forest, and then that leads him into destruction, which is a very quick way of saying the story. Basically, I was like the decoy. Yes, a lot of the aunties would say I was like the best golden deer they'd ever seen. I took a lot of...
I'm sure there's completely...
No, I'm not kidding.
Sure
I was literally just home visiting my parents last week, and like one of my aunties came up to me and was like, oh, the golden deer! And I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to live this down. I was on student council. I was in high school. Yeah, so I did a lot of public speaking. And I went to an all-girls Catholic school, which meant I got to play Proctor in The Crucible, which was kind of awesome.
Can you explain that, please, for... listeners.
So I'm trying to even remember the thing, but he's kind of like one of the main characters, and he's sort of first of all, because it was all girls, so I was very excited about that.
It's like Shakespearean theater in reverse.
Yeah, and he's sort of the fire and fury, like, preacher. He was very angry and intense, is how I would describe it. So that was very satisfying for
now,
me.
Did you...
As a, like, 15-year-old girl.
Okay. You have described in other interviews, right, this feeling of otherness even as a child, this feel, right? When you did theater, did you take on these characters? Were you one of these sort of emotional chameleons who could just like vanish into a role?
A little bit.
You were.
Yeah.
And was that a comfortable place for you? Did you enjoy going to that place?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think also like it was it made people happy. Like, I think...
And you got pleasure from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, being, like, a very masculine young person and having, like, very conservative Indian parents who are also immigrants and just trying to figure out, like, their place in the world, mm-hmm. in America, and not and really wanting to just kind of, like, be status quo, and then here's me, that it allowed me to, like, be playful and... It was pleasing to everybody because mm-hmm. it was like, oh, Prithi, she's performing. It's funny. And so as long as it was funny,
yeah,
all of those other issues where they're like, okay, she like keeps saying she's a boy. And
it trumped
like,
all that
once,
stuff.
Because it was like, I could be whatever because I'm performing.
Right.
So it took it out of the realm of everyone feeling uncomfortable about like, you know, whatever, how I wanted my haircut or what clothes I wanted to wear or things like that that made adults uncomfortable.
Did you ever do your own stuff? Did you ever perform your own stuff?
I did.
What was it?
I did this really funny thing when I was really, really young. God, it must have been like somewhere between like 7 and 10. And I played this like really sort of funny Indian priest with like a super thick Indian accent. I'm not going to do it for you. I don't think I could, honestly. But like, I mean, like that, like my parents and aunts and uncles just thought was hilarious.
This was something you wrote?
I never wrote it down.
It was a character.
I would just go
improvise?
And like, you know, in front of the fireplace and they'd be like, do that thing where you do the Indian priest guy. And I would just like do
monologue.
It.
Monologue.
Yeah.
Wow. Did this priest have a name?
No, I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
Okay.
I'll get back to you.
Is that a pleasant memory for you? It sounds pretty funny.
It's complicated. I think it's definitely... it's something I thought about more recently, and it definitely is complicated in that sense that it was, like, as much as it was, like, this sort of comedic performing part of myself coming out that was like always a part of me. It was definitely like also a place to kind of hide and please the adults around me that were clearly uncomfortable with like how I was like growing up and the person that I was.
I would imagine it was also, but it just, I mean, that seems to me also a way to maybe, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but to exercise a certain amount of anger. I mean, you say you were at a Catholic all-girls school, and yes. You're doing a priest, and it's this sort of fiery character. It would seem to me like mocking somebody like that would be a very empowering exercise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also the youngest of three, so, and my family is very loud. Like, everyone's just talking all the time, so just getting yourself heard.
Yeah, that's the classic dynamic. Yeah,
so I think that part of it as well, it's like if I perform, like I can talk and everybody listens to me, whereas in my family structure, it was like nobody listened to me. Like they were just like, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, just be quiet. Or I'd be saying something, but no one would actually pay attention. So, yeah.
Great. So talk a little bit about the sort of, I don't want to put an adjective to it. You know, you've used your restaurants. Mm-hmm. You've put your restaurants in service of certain social ends, mm-hmm. right? Both financially, you know, donating portions of certain dishes and whatnot. The fact that you're out there, you know, speaking without apology for things, you know, that are important to you. Just can you talk to me about a little bit about this? When you decided to start bringing it into the restaurants the mm-hmm. way you do, what was the evolution of that for you? And how do you, there's so much out there that needs attention. What's your decision-making template for what gets your
attention,
your attention, your support? I mean, there's you know, every chef I think who wants to be making a difference struggles with, you know, how do I decide? I could be doing, you know, I could give all my money away.
Right. And we as like chefs and restaurant owners get like hit up for like everything, right?
Well,
like,
I always say this.
Every week you're like, how many things of like, yeah, I have a pile of like and this thing and that thing that everybody wants you to be a part of and donate this thing and that thing.
I've never collaborated. When I collaborate on cookbooks and if I work with a chef in their restaurant in the morning, I almost never spent a 2-hour period with someone where either someone knocks at the door to try to sell them something mm-hmm. or ask them if they'll donate something or the restaurant phone rings and the reservationist comes over and it's a school or a hospital.
Right.
I mean, all these people all need the money. They're not doing anything wrong. But I don't know that people understand the constant...
Restaurants make no money?
No, but like also why? The constant ask...
Why are you asking us?
But I think restaurant people, it's a cliche, but are often inherently inclined to want to, you know, do things for people, make people feel good, however you want to put it. It is a constant... need to say mostly no to
right.
people who mostly probably deserve support from somebody. So anyway, how do you go about figuring it out?
I mean, I think the first thing is really just like, you know, and this is something that I've talked to. The James Beard Foundation does this boot camp where they talk to chefs about like advocacy and stuff. And one of the things that we talked about, I was just there in March, was about like pick your causes. And because you can't say yes to everybody, and your contribution is actually more powerful if you could give like $10,000 to one organization instead of $1,000 to a bunch of different organizations. And you can actually enact more real change, because if you're giving $10,000 to a nonprofit, then the executive director and the people on the board are going to want to talk to you and be like, hey, what can we do and how can we work together? So there's opportunities to actually be more impactful than just spreading a lot of donations of gift certificates and cookbooks around. I think for me, it was always, it wasn't like by all means, I didn't like open Juhu thinking like, oh, this is going to be a restaurant for social change as opposed to Nubby, which that was like part of the mission from the beginning. But we live in this place and things happen. And Jody was just in Charleston where I was talking about one of the first times. It was only after first few months that Juhu had been open. And it was when George Zimmerman was acquitted for killing Trayvon Martin. And I just immediately felt like we had to do something or say something. And, you know, as most of you might know, Oakland has like one of the largest percentage of activists and artists in the country. And a lot of those people are work for us. And so they're, you know, and a significant amount of them are a little bit younger than myself and my wife. And there was a sense of like looking up to us of like, what are you guys gonna, you know, what have we, you know. And to me, it just felt like those are the issues. So I try to focus on the issues that are in my community. So, you know, do I give a certain amount and want to speak out about Asian American issues or LGBT issues? Yes. But what's going on directly in my community in Oakland is a lot of disenfranchised and at-risk African American youth. And so that's where I'm going to put a lot of my attention in terms of the issues that I'm going to be about, because that is directly affecting my community, like right there. So one organization that we have worked with now for a number of years is called Destiny Arts Center. Does anybody here know Destiny Arts? It's an amazing organization. One of the co-founders is a good friend, Sarah Kroll. Destiny Arts is in Oakland. They teach originally self-defense, but dance and performance has kind of become the main thing to young people on a sliding scale. And so it gives them an opportunity to express themselves. And, you know, some of the stats I've heard from the executive director and people on the staff is that a lot of the kids that were fully enrolled, so they do a show, if you ever want to see like the most amazing show that will make you laugh and cry your eyes out and just be blown away, every April they do like an actual show company, like the kids have to audition to be a part of it, and they express like all the things that are going on in their community, whether that's like gang violence, sexual assault, immigration issues, gentrification, what have you. And, you know, we're living today in a world where like education, public education, is not what it used to be. Like, kids don't have access to music class and drama class and all of these ways to express themselves. And so it really provides so much more than just learning to dance. It's really an opportunity for kids to get out all of these things that they're going through. And all of the kids that are part of that company in over 25 years, they have a 100% high school graduation rate. And that just sold me. Like, yeah. That's it. You know, it's like kids need opportunities to kind of talk about and express all the shit they're going through. And that those are the kids like in our direct community. Those kids are the ones who are going to be applying for a job in 2 years at your restaurant. And or they're going to be the kids mugging you. Which one do you want? And do we want to wait until you get mugged and then be like, oh, let's call the police? Or do we want to actually do something in our communities to make sure that that never happens? And the way that that never happens is not by, like, policing kids. It's by giving them opportunities to, like, learn and express themselves.
Yeah. Great. I was stunned. I just checked the time. I thought I was going to see we had, like, 25 minutes left, and we're, like, virtually out of time here. First of all, I have to ask you, when you just said the thing about the 100% graduation rate, there was a transformation that happened with you, I think. It looked like that really hit you on a real...
It does, yeah.
Yeah, what about that really... What about that piece of it is so touching to you?
Well, honestly, I mean, those of you who are in this industry have probably noticed that they just keep getting younger and younger. And to me, every time I want to bitch about millennials and how frustrating they are as employees, I stop myself and I can't blame them. I blame the GOP. I blame this world that they are growing up in, that they, you know, I feel like, you know, I was born in 76. I feel like I'm one of the last generation of people that grew up believing in the American dream as a kid and thinking that it was actually possible, that if you just worked really hard and studied really hard, that you're going to be okay. And that's just no longer true. And I feel like that is a mind fuck for 20-somethings and 17-year-olds to grow up in that world. And many of them didn't have the privileges that I had. And so it's even worse. And so I feel like it's just, to me, we all kind of throw our hands up and go, oh, how do we fix this? And to me, it's just so intense that just by giving kids an opportunity, like, it just means so much because, the cliche, like, that's our future.
Yeah. Last question.
Yes.
There's a lot of people here who have been attending the Food Media Lab. These are people who are aspiring to be in food media, whether it's writing, podcasting, whatever, books, articles, whatever medium they choose, maybe more than one. This show is mostly listened to by cooks. I don't have that scientifically, but it's who I hear from. I know people listen to it during prep time. I know people listen to it on their commutes to work. So as someone who really lives, I say this once in a while when certain guests come on, you know, it's easy to Instagram, it's easy to tweet, it's easy to talk. You actually walk the walk on a lot of this stuff.
I try.
You're deeply involved. There's the performer. But journalists who are sitting here, future mm-hmm. journalists, mm-hmm. okay, cooks who are listening, mm-hmm. maybe as small groups of them, what are people missing? I mean, you could probably spend all night on it, but what is there that doesn't get asked of the media, or that you think where you think the media fails mm-hmm. With some of these things, and where do you think the industry could be doing more, maybe without breaking their backs, right? Maybe just small things an individual restaurant could do.
Yeah.
I'll give you the floor as the last question. What do you think these people could be doing to make a difference, you know, in a scaled down way that they don't have to devote all their time and energy to?
I think that the first thing really in terms of the media is like being more like clear on how we value different people and different cuisines. I think that there's this tendency and then at the same time, there's like this pendulum kind of swing, right? Where it's like, oh, like me too. So now let's be all about women and people of color. And it's like, when is that going to swing back the other direction? Like, why not actually be interested in different stories and see what is possible when we stop sort of putting some people on a pedestal or certain cuisines from certain, you know, countries up here and having different set of expectations for another cuisine or chef of a particular ethnic origin. So I think that like the media could just do more to really focus on real stories and not just, you know, and I know it's hard because there's no money and it's challenging when you have a lot to do and you get this PR pitch in front of you and it feels like, okay, I'll just go with this. But yeah, there's just so much that's so much more interesting than the types of stories that get picked up because they're coming from the big PR firm and things like that. And I think that like for cooks, I just think like most importantly is just like trusting your gut and like doing you. You know, I mean, obviously, if you're working in a restaurant, like, yes, chef, and you should learn things. I believe in that.
Yeah.
I do believe strongly in that, that we, you know, it's not like you just, like, go to culinary school and are like, this is me.
Right.
You should learn things from other people. Find good people to learn them from. Find the right people to learn them from. And if you end up with the wrong people, then learn from their mistakes. But really, after you do all that, just, like, trust your gut and like do what feels right to you, because most likely if it resonates with you and it makes sense, and it's not about trying to impress people, but just like what's real. Because I think if people just stop trying so hard to like follow the trends or like impress other people and just focused on like what feels real and right to them and their cooking or writing, that they'll probably be a lot more successful.
Great. Thank you. Can we have a round of applause for Preeti Mistry,
please? Thank
you.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We are going to pick up with the second interview from our live show at San Francisco Cooking School. Okay, so Jody, tell us a little bit about the school. You founded this. You were like many people who come to learn here. You were a career switcher.
I was. I've been in the business 21 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Went to culinary school myself with the intention of one day opening a cooking school.
Mm-hmm.
It took 14 years of trial, error, and working in all aspects of the food business mm-hmm. to finally come around to making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Probably about 8 years ago, I finally got to the point where so many of my colleagues who were chefs, mm-hmm. pastry chefs, complained all the time about students coming into their kitchens from more classic training programs.
Mm-hmm.
They thought culinary school was a waste of time. You see it a lot when you go eat at an open kitchen and someone on the dining side says to the cook on the other side, "Oh man, I'm thinking about going to culinary school."
Mm-hmm.
The cook's first response is, "Don't do it.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Yeah. Waste of time, waste of money."
Yeah.
And so I pulled 16 chefs together and just said, what would change your mind about that?
Mm.
Can we reinvent the way we teach people how to cook that would make it worthwhile?
When you say pull them together, you mean you pulled them en masse in a group and had like a round
both.
Table?
We did that and we did one-on-one. So we spent a year before we opened the school individually talking to people, talking to chefs in groups, putting paper on the wall and making lists of everything they wish a cook had under their belt before they walked into their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most interesting outcome was not anything technical.
Mm.
The technical skills are exactly what you would expect them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Proficient using a knife, knowing how to pipe chocolate,
mm-hmm.
repetition with a lot of those things. It was really what I call the soft skills
mm.
that consistently came up as the things people felt weren't being taught anywhere
mm-hmm.
else.
Soft skills meaning what?
I put them in three buckets. One of them is work habits,
mm-hmm.
knowing how to listen in a kitchen, mm-hmm. knowing when not to talk, how
mm-hmm.
to set up a station, how to work tidy, how to ask questions, how to take feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Feedback in a kitchen is really direct, and you need to be really good at being okay with saying yes, chef, and just changing what you do.
Yeah.
And that's tough for some people.
Yes.
So work habits is one part of that. Knowing how to taste food came up mm. a lot, too. Saying, you know, students come in my kitchen to work or recent culinary school graduates and they don't know how to make the food taste as good as it should. No one's really taught them how to do that. They can follow
right.
a recipe fine.
Right.
But they need to make my food taste like my food.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of practice. You don't ever
yeah.
master it. Whether you're brand new at cooking or you're Thomas Keller,
yeah.
you're always getting better at it.
Yes.
But if we can start to teach you how to do that here, you're so much better prepared when you walk out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So taste is a big part. And then the final part is getting people unshackled from a recipe
mm.
and teaching more from the perspective of method, technique, ratio versus follow a recipe from A to Z.
Bringing people to a place where they can operate on intuition.
Intuition, we talk about it all
or
the time.
Or informed intuition.
Yeah.
Right?
Daniel Patterson said to me from the beginning, he said, "Jody, people walk in my kitchen and they're just recipe robots."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I just need people to follow a recipe, they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if I stop someone and say, "Why are you browning the bones for the veal stock?" which is the right thing to do,
mm-hmm.
their answer is because it's on the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever taught that person what's happening when you're browning bones.
Mm.
What if you brown them too far? What if you don't brown them enough?
Yeah.
And so really every single day you're here, we come at it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. It's funny. I don't think she'd mind me saying this. I had lunch right when I got off the plane Sunday with Jesse Kuhl of the Flea Street Cafe. People outside of this area probably don't know who Jesse is. She
He's
is
amazing.
A local
legend.
She's also a ton of fun. She picked me up. I said, "How you doing?" This was Sunday morning. She goes, I went out dancing last night with Joan at a Latin club. Joan is Joan freaking Baez.
Oh, my God.
Who she's been friends with forever. I mean, that's Jessie.
Yeah.
But she told me she's hired several people out of this school, and she said it is very – I'm not saying this because you and I are friends, but she said it is – there is a difference that people discern.
I think there's also, we're really honest about what we're training people to do. We're not training people to be chefs.
Right.
It is a huge pet peeve of mine when I see other schools throw banners out that say, we'll train you to be a chef in 6 months. Nobody graduates from school a chef. You work years in this business before you can add that title to your name. I'm training you to be a cook.
Yeah.
And a really good one.
Other schools say we'll train you to be a chef?
Tons.
Because people have heard it on this show a million times. You know, we interview people and they go, I got out of cooking school and I thought I was a chef. And I'm like, well, where'd you get that idea? Is it from the school?
It's from a lot of schools.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that's really,
to me, you're
that's
just
really
between
off the
that
mark.
And a lot of things you see in food media.
Yeah.
It would be very easy to go into this with blinders on.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't do that. We're really honest about what you're going to get paid, what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And not everyone wants to work in a restaurant. It's part of what launched the Food Media Lab. There are a lot of people that want a culinary education to apply to a different aspect of this business.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Thank you for all that. Now, we did a panel. When you and I spoke about doing this live event, I mentioned the event we did in Brooklyn where we did a headliner interview one-on-one, and then a panel. And the panel there was very local. And my first thought was, let's do a tribute to Judy Rogers, the late, great, amazing chef of Zuni Cafe. We kind of put our heads together on who to ask. We kind of got our list.
I think it was a great group.
Yeah, so we had, this is who people are about to hear, we had Nate Norris, who is currently the chef of Zuni Cafe. We had Brandon Jew, who was the chef of Mr. Jew's, and before that at Bar Agricole, who was probably, I guess, the youngest person on the panel. He was like the youngest generation to have worked there.
Right.
Who's not there anymore.
Correct.
In our panel. We had Gail Peary and John Clark, who are the couple behind Foreign Cinema, who basically ran that kitchen at one point in time.
In the 80s, yeah.
In the 80s. And then Brandon suggested that we get Quang Nguyen, who has been at the restaurant since before. A lot of people don't know this. That a lot of people don't know Alfred Portale wasn't the first chef at the Gotham. A lot of people don't know Michael Romano was not the original chef of Union Square Cafe. A lot of people do not know that Judy Rogers was not the opening chef of Zuni Cafe. She came back. She came in like what? Like almost eight years after it opened. As Gail Peary says in this interview, you know, a couple years after she got there, we were still serving the guacamole.
Right,
I love that line.
Right.
Because it was a Southwestern restaurant.
Yeah.
I think Judy in part was hired because she had taken a gig in New York at this nothing restaurant across the street from Bloomingdale's called Yellow Fingers, which was a Southwestern restaurant.
That's funny.
I think there was a direct link between her being there and her coming back west and getting that gig. I think. It was very sweet. Everyone was very protective of Quang. He has never done an interview. He has a fairly pronounced accent. He was a little, I think, the way it was probably suspicious of the media that he didn't put it that way. But he ended up being this, like, you said it to me, he was kind of the star.
And he just glowed.
He glowed.
He's
he
very
was,
proud of what he does.
He's
you can't
proud of
see
what he
smile
does.
Because it's a podcast, but he was grinning proudly the entire time.
Yeah, he got dressed up. I mean,
right.
Not like in a tux, but for a cook,
yeah.
He was the most dressed up person on the stage
for
by
sure.
Far. You know, Pri and I both were dressed like we were, and for that matter, John didn't even have sleeves on his t-shirt.
Right.
You know, I mean, this was a casual group.
Yeah.
And he really took pride in how he came to this thing.
Yeah.
And he was charming. When I went to see him before the show, just to introduce myself, he took me downstairs. He showed me, you know, his station. He showed me his knives. He showed me all the butchery he had done that was in the walk-in. This guy, I mean, you know, he was something else. Anyway, Judy Rogers, what do we want to say about? I mean, most people listening to this probably know she was an absolute legend. She was very famous for this chicken for two that's still on the menu there. There's an anchovy plate they do that's still there. There's a Caesar salad that's very famous, and she was known for doing food that presented, I guess, as rustic, but which had the same exactitude behind it and theory behind it is probably the most complicated sort of modernist avant-garde food you could ever see. It's just it didn't look like that.
But there was
as much thought. And these people talked about this at great length, and I thought very eloquently.
It came down to me, her attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
sort of left no stone unturned. Mm-hmm. I think it was Gail who talks about the number of different olive oils that were in the kitchen and how every single one had a different application.
Yeah.
And every month those might change.
Yes.
And, I mean, it's hard to sustain that in a kitchen, especially that size.
Yeah.
But Brandon used the word perfection. And right. And that's a big word.
Right. And it doesn't look that way.
Right.
You know, and I think it is very telling the people who spend time at that restaurant. You know, there's a story I love to tell. I was upstairs having lunch one day. I was in town and a bunch of people who had worked at Stars, including Jeremiah Tower. You know, they had done an event the night before. It was like a reunion thing, and they went to lunch at Zuni. And while we were sitting up on the balcony having lunch, our server comes over and says, Mr. Tower, Jonathan Waxman is downstairs. He wants to say hello. Neither of them live here anymore, but, you know, of course that's where they are.
Of course that's where
you know,
they are.
And Tower used to sit outside in the afternoon over there and write, like, his handwritten correspondence to people, sit there with a glass of champagne. That was where he did it. You know, and that was a guy with a pretty exacting palate. So it's it doesn't look that way. It doesn't look fussy, but you know, when you taste it, it is still pretty perfect. And and also there's all these people who are happily putting themselves in the service of her legacy. I mean, I was really, we talk about this in the interview. Nate is the executive chef there. This is a guy who's paid his dues, and he is very clearly proud to be carrying on a tradition there, you know?
And I think Gail and John clearly live through her legacy and much of what they do in their kitchen as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, I think that's all we need to say about that. So with that, oh, there is one other thing. We did this class on podcasting. I call it a module because I spoke solo on like the what goes into making a show, and then Salil Ho, who was like undercover here, right? No one was allowed to take pictures of her. She's the new Chronicle critic, relatively new, and Brian Hogan Stewart, who has a show called Salt and Spine, which I had not listened to until I was getting ready to be with those guys. He's really good on air. He's very like. I'm not so into the unprepared hosts, you know?
Yeah.
He is really buttoned down on the air. He's really good. So I highly recommend that if you listen to this, if you're a cookbook aficionado, I would also recommend you to Racist Sandwich, the show that Salil co-hosted, but that is no longer because she got this plum job reviewing restaurants.
Right.
Okay,
it's on hiatus. It might come back.
Hiatus. if it comes back, you'll know that she's not a happy person. Sorry, I don't know you well enough for that, Salil, but come on. So what I was going to say is then we broke up into groups and we did practice prep sessions. And you were the subject of one prep session. We got in a circle and we came up with questions. People were supposed to have done their homework. And the one thing nobody had really done homework.
Right.
And so this space used to be the restaurant Speedo 690. Which was a Jeremiah Tower restaurant. It existed at the same time as Stars, which was his landmark restaurant. And nobody asked that question. Nobody. And I called that, I didn't yell, and I wasn't that much of a jerk, but I was like, guys, that's a research fail. Right?
That's why you were there. You were at the
That's why I was there.
Yeah.
But here's what happened. One of the things that was so intriguing to me about having Kwong on the panel last night was that he predated Judy at Zuni. And I made a big deal about that in the live situation. And then I said, Gail, you know, what are your first memories of Judy? And she goes, well, you know, I just have to say that I was actually also at the restaurant before Judy. So for me, that was a research fail, right?
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
You're nodding.
Yeah.
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 But I feel the only thing I regret is not saying it in the moment because there were a lot of those students there. And I'm sure the ones who were in our little group, our workshop group, were
they probably loved to
see
that.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But you know what? Those of you who are listening to the show, who were there, you saw how much that cost me. Not
maybe
a lot because I know Gail.
Yeah.
Yes, but if Gail and I didn't have a relationship,
correct,
that would have been a bad thing.
Right.
We have enough in the bank that I don't think that was a big deal.
Right.
And she's a forgiving type and is a very spiritual person. And I will make a separate apology to her for that. But that is not what that should not happen.
Right.
And I normally would probably edit it out of the audio. But since this was part of this school, I'm leaving it in.
Great. I think it's a good lesson learned.
It is really good.
Yeah.
And for anyone out there who does do interviewing, that is an example of a really bad. I think a lot of people, You know, someone came up to me this afternoon during the little, I don't know what we, I call it the wrap party. You said it wasn't a wrap party, but I don't know. This thing was over and there was alcohol.
Right.
Isn't that a wrap party?
Enough. Yeah. Sure.
So I don't want to say her name, but one of the students came up and said, you know, a number of writers have told her that you need to think about your time relative to what you get paid, right? So if you don't get paid very much by a certain publication, don't invest that much time into the piece. Because why? To which I said, like, well, if you're trying to make a name for yourself, you need that breakout story. You know, you can't look at it that way. You have to research everything like it's for the New Yorker.
Well, and it's also, I think there's no excuse not to these days, because being able to do a deep dive into somebody is so much easier than it ever used to be.
Oh, sure.
And people know if all you did was click on the first search result and got their, you know, generic Wikipedia page.
Wikipedia is, people can tell Wikipedia.
Instantly.
Yeah.
So take the time to dive deep. It isn't that hard. And the info's all out there.
It's all there. It isn't that hard. But to me, but it is. Like, you know, you want to have that one piece that where people go, oh, my God. You right. know, like, this person can write.
Right.
And you can't look at it that way. You just can't. Anyway, having said all that, I'm going to now turn it over to my interview at San Francisco Cooking School and the Food Media Lab with a panel of people who knew and worked with the late, great Judy Rogers, Nate Norris, Quang Nguyen, John Clark, Gail Peary, and Brandon Ju. Here you go. So we are now going to do a tribute to the late, great Chef Judy Rogers. I'm sure doesn't really need probably an introduction in this town, in this room, in this country maybe. But of course, Judy was the longtime chef of Zuni Cafe, a restaurant that I still love. I tried to have lunch. I didn't realize that you guys weren't open on Mondays. I tried to sneak out yesterday for an hour and go do that. I thought it would be great while I was here in town and doing a live show. I couldn't think of a more appropriate topic than to sort of reminisce and pay tribute to just this incredibly important figure in American cuisine. So we have here five people, all of whom worked with Judy, two of whom are still with Zuni Cafe. I'll just quickly introduce everybody. Nate Norris is currently the executive chef of Zuni. Next to Nate is Quang Nguyen. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate you mouthing it with me. That was helpful. this is an amazing... and Brendan, we have you to thank for this. It was your suggestion. Quang actually... I don't know if people know this. Judy Rogers was not the original chef of Zuni Cafe. She came into the restaurant in the mid-1980s. Quang actually predated Judy at Zuni and is still at Zuni. He does not work the line. You butcher. You do a lot of prep. You're sort of this at least publicly the unsung hero of that kitchen.
I went
to do introduce myself this afternoon, and Quang told me everyone in cooking school learns how to dice onions incorrectly. And if anyone's been to cooking school, it's usually this way, and then this way, and then you get your dice. He does it in two steps. I still don't know how you do it. I saw it coming, and I don't know how you eliminated one of those. But anyway, John Clark and Gail Peary, a foreign cinema restaurant, who worked together at Zuni for years, also authors of the Foreign Cinema Cookbook, which is dedicated, I believe you used the word mentor in the dedication, to Judy Rogers. And Brendan Ju from Mr. Ju's and before that Bar Agricole. I haven't been to your current restaurant, but I'll get there. But I did have your food at Bar Agricole. Anyway, can we have a welcome for this group? It's kind of an amazing group. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for giving us your time tonight. You know, when we had the idea of doing this, I was kind of amazed that it came together as quickly as it did and as smoothly as it did. And it's kind of like a dream group for us. I guess, Quang, can we start with you, please?
I can do what I can.
I have to say, you're doing us a huge favor. This is not, Quang doesn't do a lot of interviews.
kind of spends his days downstairs, showed me the space today, unlocked your drawer, showed me all your knives and everything. Just very quickly, what was your first memory of being at that restaurant and meeting?
So the first time she coming with a wood shoe.
Wooden shoe.
Wooden shoe. She walk from the stair. Everybody here, cop, cop. Cop, 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 cop. So that would everybody remember. The next day she came in, if we hear cop, 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 she know what she
goes. That was the first memory? That's an entrance. Yeah. That's an entrance. Gail, can you talk to me a little about she was such an important figure in your life. I mean, personally and professionally. When you just think back, if I just throw her, when I mention her, when someone mentions her, What's the first sort of image, moment, memory? What's sort of the first thing for you?
Well, when you asked Kwong what his first memory was, I was hired before Judy myself. So Kathy Riley.
I did not realize that.
Well, this is why we're all here, right? We learned something new. But Kathy Riley had hired me, and she was there several months, and then she was on her way out to raise a child, and then it was very. Confusing time for the restaurant, but Judy showed up wearing clogs, yeah, but she also running around the restaurant with a Williams Sonoma bag, and she was looking at everybody's station, and she came over to my station, had a recipe for polenta on the wall, and she was reading it, and she was looking at me, and I had 10 twists of pepper on the recipe. She goes, oh, I like that. And I would say that I didn't know what was coming because I was an art student working my way through college in San Francisco, and it was a gig. It was just like, I'm making money, I'm going to work here because it's so beautiful, and I'm going to learn something. But I had no idea the depth of knowledge that I would be close to and dipping into the well and just being around for that. So we got to see the oven put in. We got to see the grill put in. She arrived full Monty, and the rest is history. So,
I'm surprised when you say that you had a number of twists of pepper on the recipe. When I think of the way she's known for cooking, the way her book was written, the Zuni Cafe cookbook,
it was sarcastic.
Oh, it was sarcastic. Uh-huh. Okay, got it. Okay.
Well, I was 21, I didn't know what I was doing.
So she thought that was a little silly.
She thought it was an interesting detail, but she was also, doing a, she was sizing me up.
She was taking a mental picture of what needed
child.
To happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. John, how about you?
I guess my first impression was I arrived after Gail by several months. And she interviewed me. Actually, there's an interim two chefs who were hired ahead of Judy. That was Kelsey and Marsha. They were actually hired to be the chefs. And then Billy was able to convince Judy to take the job.
This is Billy West?
Yeah. So then they put Judy on top of everybody. So I was interviewed. Judy interviewed me and then promptly took off for 5 weeks to...
Africa.
To South Africa. So we didn't see her. Actually, the first 5 weeks we had a lady by the name of Catherine Brandella, chef, show up and help us through it.
Was this one of the Chez Panisse kind of...
Chez Panisse, yeah. Catherine had
people who
would
periodically get like tapped for this kind of thing, part of the sisterhood. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then Judy came back and, it was a very tumultuous period at that time. Everybody working together, menus changing every day. The workload was, I did grill, so the workload was pretty intense. And Judy was very, I don't remember Judy being in my station much of the time. She would be over there looking at something, but usually it was Marsha, and she would be someplace else cooking or thinking of a new dish, working out of a book, something she had.
Mm-hmm.
I remember her at the time, I don't know at the time there was a lot of humor. Was there a lot of humor then? It was pretty matter of fact.
Yeah, Judy smoked cigarettes and drank a lot of wine.
Okay.
So that was fun.
Drank a lot of wine.
Yeah. No, it was, it was a reckoning. It was really a reckoning. It was quite something.
She was...
From this perspective at this point now, to have
So this anticipates something for me, right? That restaurant, first of all, it opened sort of inauspiciously. Half of the restaurant was... was it a cactus shop? What was the half of that restaurant?
Well, the original restaurant, I believe, is the doorway all the way to the end against the brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
That's the original restaurant with the bathroom in the back corner. And Billy West worked in the back. About a year or two later, he took the site next door,
mm-hmm.
which is essentially ends where the wall of the kitchen is. And then the triangular area was Red Desert Cactus Shop.
Cactus Shop.
Yeah, and it was Red Desert. And it was there. We shopped at Red Desert.
We bought succulents there.
We bought stuff there. We bought these things and put them in our apartment.
That's what you did.
But when I started Zuni, they had already taken over that site. Red Desert had moved across the street in the alley, and they were already starting to expand into the new bar area.
Yeah. So the thing I always wonder when you look back at moments in time like this, right, is at some point that restaurant became the Zuni Cafe we think of today. Still, it became this very important restaurant. It became the home of one of the most iconic dishes. That's a word that's overused, but it's appropriate here, the chicken there. Which was transmitted to everyone via the cookbook. That's probably the dish most people know from that book. Do you guys have a sense of when you started to understand that restaurant had become or was on its way to becoming, you know, this restaurant of lore, this important place? Do you even recognize something like that in the moment, or is it not until you look back?
You know, it's funny because I can say this. After being there a few months, we had a chef from France come in, Pepet Arbulo, who worked with us, Judy's mentor. And we had just finished the grill?
The oven
and the grill. And I don't know if it's iconic or what, but she was serving a duck bones and carcass. Yeah. Roasted in the oven, and it was pulled out, and you'd put persillado on it, and you'd put it in a plate and send it out.
So we were serving bones on a plate.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty radical. I mean, it was very radical because there wasn't that many wood-fired ovens. You really have to go back to 88 in the city. There was Tommaso's. There was no Delfina. I mean, this was pretty good, kind of rustic urban cooking that was laying the groundwork down for what everybody does now. Everybody has a wood-fired grill and a wood-fired oven. But no, I think we were thinking it was pretty cool because Elizabeth David came, wow. Richard Olney came,
yeah, but
Jeremiah Tower was there.
Let me interrupt. This was bones on a plate that were roasted. And I remember, you know, sending out the two or three that we sold over the course of the week and just thinking, what the hell is going on here?
You were supposed to, you know, pick the little pick bits it, but off of it.
I was training and had a job before this as a saucier at a restaurant. So I showed up there and I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? Because there was no sauces, there was nothing. And it was completely just different from what I was thinking at the time. I did come around and enjoy it and then, you know, was able to do some things for Judy. But I just remember that. Those duck bones.
But this to you guys was what? Kind of emblematic of kind of the confidence and the fact that there was a following that would order something like that? That you could get away with?
It was shocking.
And it was sheer wonder. I mean, sheer wonder.
Yeah.
And this is before the chicken. This is before the Caesar. We were still doing guacamole. You know, it was a world, it was a transgressional world. And then, you know, the city basically shut down the mojitos. They said, you can no longer serve guacamole and those things.
Was that
and
like a health department away. Thing?
Yeah.
What was the issue?
Stat.
Well, the mojitos carved out of...
is it because it's porous?
You
it's
cannot
porous.
Oh, sanitize it.
Oh, because it'll hold on to
they didn't
bacteria.
Think could, they didn't think you could clean it properly.
Right.
But yeah, we sold... Zuni was famous for that. Margaritas, cosmopolitans, and fried chips to order.
Anyway,
and that was what we were afraid of, famous for.
It was a lot of, you know, swirling worlds colliding.
Yes.
Yeah, we sell a lot of those, but some other way, you know, by the inspector coming, you cannot do that, so we stopped it.
Got it.
And it was guacamole by
it's
order.
Very good. Even the duck bone we still have, but once a year from now.
Once a year?
Oh my God. Once a year.
Okay.
We still have it.
Brandon, can you talk to me? You come into this place that's already sort of like, you know, it has this historic reputation. What was it like for you coming to that restaurant, coming into a restaurant like that as a young cook? Like, what was that? What was the import of that to your own career? What did it mean to you to go to a place like that,
yeah,
as opposed to just another, you know, another gig on your way to sort of becoming a chef?
I mean, I was there in 2002. So my cooking career had taken me from, I was in a university studying biology and cooking on the side just because I enjoyed it. Got really into it, and just every year I would get into better and better restaurants. And by the time I graduated, I knew I wanted to cook, and so I moved to Italy. So after a year working in Italy, I came back to San Francisco, where I'm from, and Zuni was the first place that I worked at in San Francisco. And to be honest, like, it was a place that I think how they educated the cooks and how, like Judy's approach was, I mean, she had her own process, and I think she was a master of her own recipe. At the time that I was there, she had become a master of her recipes.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning, like, I would make ricotta gnocchi, you know, every day. And every day I'd give her a tester, and every day she knew exactly what was slightly different about it. And she knew how to correct it to make it right. So I think for me, like, when I was in Italy, I worked for kind of like a crazy tyrant chef. And so I came out of college going to Italy kind of like on my own, and like cooked there for a year, and it was kind of on my own, like, and that was like the world I was in. Like, it was crazy. I mean, I lived upstairs from the restaurant in Italy. I worked downstairs. I worked lunch and dinner. It was a Michelin star restaurant. And we just, like, there was three of us.
Oh, so they had like staff quarters, like,
yeah,
kind of a barracks type
totally
situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I got to Zuni, I was just, the approach of how she was teaching, and kind of it was a lot more scholarly, I thought. So I really enjoyed, like, being able to ask her intellectual questions about the food and her give an intellectual answer back. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of chefs would just be like, just do it because I want you to do it that way.
Right, because that's how we do it.
Yeah.
Do you remember what kind of, like, what an example might, I mean, it's been a while, so
yeah,
if you can't, it's fine. But
yeah,
what, when you say an intellectual answer, I mean, what's so interesting to me is, you know, that food as an eater, right, as a diner, it seems so simple,
yeah,
right? And it is in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
But the it's becoming a cliche to say this, but
well, yeah,
that's harder, right? Because there's this is the line that's the cliche. I just don't know how else to say
it. I mean,
there's nowhere to hide with that kind of food. You really
totally
have to nail it.
Totally. I mean, going back to the ricotta gnocchi, I mean, we got into this really long discussion about the shape of the spoon. Like, there's a very specific shape that when you have your finger come off of that spoon, how it should be shaped so it goes into the water, so that the water has to be simmering at the right level for it to actually, when it hits the water, for the simmering water to actually kind of tumble the ricotta like gnocchi.
Yeah.
And so she knew if there was some times where people were like, oh my God, where is the spoon? You know, and we would have to be like, oh, well, no one can find it. We got to use this other spoon. And
yeah,
like, let's see. And she's like, what happened to these? Yeah, this is not the right one. And, you know, it's like things like that, you know, she was just was to me, like, she had a really sophisticated palate.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to communicate, I thought, to explain what she was looking for. And, you know, I mean, she was very particular. She's a very particular person and chef.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I came to enjoy, like, cooking for her for that reason.
how, you know, it's interesting because, you know, she's always fascinated me because most people probably don't know this. She spent time with the Trois Gros family as a teenager.
Yeah.
A little bit of time in the restaurants. A lot of time at home where the sister, I forget the name of him, but would often cook for her. She saw a lot of the prep happen at the restaurant. Comes back with the sheafs of, like, recipes that she recorded herself. But I think if you ask most people about the food, you know, it's interesting that you came from Italy to go there, right? Because I think a lot of the simplicity of it suggests Italy, right? As opposed to France.
Yeah.
But to hear you, you know, the way you talk about when you start using words like, you know, sophisticated and, you know, very often the attraction of Italian food to people is that they use different adjectives, right? Mm. Simplicity, uncomplicated. The food doesn't go through this, like, you know, all these transformative steps.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
but
from the
outside, it's interesting to me that you went from Italy to that restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, from the outside, it does look very simple, but I think she was really in tune with the very small details that made a simple dish very complicated. And mm-hmm. she purposely made things complicated to dissect something very simple and make it really delicious.
Like, yeah.
And like perfect, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a big word.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I consider her a master for sure of her craft.
Nate, can you, well, first of all, as I've been asking, your memories, you know, you're just in a nutshell, like sort of how you remember Judy, but then also to be kind of charged today with the sort of the stewardship of that place, it would seem to me that that would be a huge pressure. Because people, I told this story all the time. A couple years ago, I told it to I think David, who works here, who was having an early dinner at the restaurant tonight. There was a day years ago where I had been at the Foreign Cinema Stars. You guys recreated Stars for one night. It was a Jeremiah Tower dinner. And the next day, he took some of his old cooks to lunch at Zuni, and they invited me to come along. We were upstairs. And at one point, the server comes over and says, Chef Tower, Jonathan Waxman is having lunch downstairs. He'd like to say hello. And neither of these guys lives here anymore, you know? And, like, they're both in town. And, like, of course they're at Zuni Cafe for lunch, right? But this is the place that restaurant occupies still. What's it like to be charged with that? What are the special challenges and privileges of that?
It is a real privilege to get to do what I do at Zuni and be a chef there of a restaurant that's so established. And to have so many pieces that are there that are in ways kind of unchanged, that there's like an institutional memory that exists there. We're a big restaurant, nearly 100 employees, and so there's plenty of folks that have just spent a matter of months at Zuni that are on our team. But there's also a number of people who've been there for decades. Kwong is really the heart and soul, like the core of that. But we have another guy in the prep kitchen, Carlos, who's been there 32 years. And the chicken's the same way every day when you come in, because Judy spent days, hours with Carlos going over how you salt these chickens every day to ensure that the hundreds you're doing at one time all are the same.
Right.
And it goes to, you know, Brandon's comments on her the analytical nature of Judy's approach to cooking, her academic approach. And I think one thing that hasn't been touched on that was really striking to me about Judy was her memory of how something was 25 years ago when she had it, when she was in this town, and or when she had it when she was even in high school in France as a foreign exchange student. I think those memory things really, really speak to how she was able to keep the restaurant the same for so long. She didn't have to have her nose in everything every day, although she did.
Yeah.
But when we wanted to pull something back from, you know, 10 years ago we hadn't done, it was right there. She was like, no, like this. And she could just get in there and be the teacher and show you how it was done. And she was a chef, but she was an academic. And she probably would have told you
Nate's
could have been
there. I mean, Nate was there when I was there.
Yeah.
So he's been there for a real long time, too. And Kwong, I mean, Kwong is the MacGyver of kitchens.
The MacGyver?
Yes.
Meaning what? Well, I mean, I know what that would mean, but what exactly do you mean?
These guys have way more, like, I just remember the couple of times passing by his prep table.
So when he cuts onions, he has a fan so that...
This is what I saw this
afternoon. Okay, you saw that, right?
I'm still
probably laughs. Like, the guys next to him are, like, crying, and he's not. But, like, when he makes carpaccio, too, I thought that was really, you know, ingenious that he was using the weight of a rolling pin and being very light about it, but very precise. He has a lot of different tools, and he's, Kwong is, he's amazing. He's a legend. Like, he's a legend.
Thank you.
If I could say also on that, I feel like we've all worked with and for Judy, and I've worked with a lot of really talented people there who've gone on to be really successful, but Kwong and Judy were different. They were peers. Then Judy didn't have peers. I imagine John and Gail will remember it as such. But Judy stood on her own, and there were probably people she respected outside of the restaurant. She certainly respected people that worked for her, but never as peers. But Kwong, I always felt that Kwong was an equal to Judy in the restaurant. She would turn to him with questions. Judy never asked me anything except where something was or why was it wrong.
Can you?
Yeah, I've been working with Judy for a long time, so I just see my sister.
Your sister?
Not my boss, sister.
Well, I think it's interesting.
I learn a lot from her, and she very, very, you know, you every little detail. She created the food very simple and very good, and we taste even the stuff we on the menu. And we taste it. She don't like it. We cut it out.
Yeah.
Change another one right in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Have a new.
But it's also interesting to me, Kwong, that you didn't work the line. You're not up. You don't work up. You know. I came to visit you this afternoon. You showed me the bacon, the pancetta, the sausages. But the lamb, you told me how long it takes, how little time it takes you to butcher a lamb. But what's interesting to me is that, you know, that was your part of the process, and that she was that involved with the building blocks, right? That's very telling, I think. And also, well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, just asking.
Well, no. It's interesting to me. You said something a minute ago, Brent. Like, I think, you know, they always say about film directors that the best ones are open to an idea, you know, from anybody. You know, Preeti a minute ago was saying, like, you know, a lot of you come up as a young cook, and a lot of the time it's like, this is how we do it. And I think, if I'm hearing everybody correctly, there was a way to do it, but she wasn't above taking in an idea, whether it was an organizational thought or something about a dish, and if it made sense, applying it. Accurate?
Yes.
Yeah?
But she pretty much was the ultimate. She knew what she wanted, and she knew how it should taste.
Yeah.
And she pretty much was driving this ship, and you know, right from the get-go. You know, she knew it didn't have to be Southwestern,
yeah.
And that she was going to turn to the food of the wonderful grandmothers of the universe,
right?
In France, Spain,
yeah,
Italy, even Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, it just Austria. She knew it was going to be old world food. She didn't want architecture or innovation for innovation's sake. She wanted flavors that she wanted to eat.
Yeah.
And to recreate that at the time.
Yes. Is it, to me from the outside, I find it kind of remarkable. I mean, she's been gone for several years. She's still so associated with that restaurant. I mean, we're here now talking about her with the current chef of the restaurant, with people who had been there for years, for people who were there for years, from people across multiple generations. I think it's quite something. I think it's a very rare thing. I'm hard-pressed to think of another restaurant where the person who so defined it, you know, has passed away, and yet the restaurant is still so defined by their signature dishes, by their style, by their philosophy. I'm really hard-pressed to it. Is it surprising to any of you that this happened, or is this pretty much what you guys would have expected?
Well, you think about Barbara Trop in San Francisco, with China Moon, but she's gone. You think about Joyce Goldstein, who's still around, doing good work, but her restaurant's gone.
But her restaurant's gone.
You think about Cindy Paulson, who's still around, you know, working around, but not the same thing. So I think it's really unique.
Yeah.
I think it's incredibly unique.
Could you have seen it from years ago? Or would you have expected this? Did it feel like she was that big a big enough force that this would almost... I mean, there's almost, to me, a... I don't know.
She was a force to reckon with.
Yeah.
Well, I think one thing that was being done at the time, back in 87, was she was at 1088. She was trying to create dishes that she could do year after year that were staples on the menu. I think that was something that she was really working towards.
Yeah.
And so the perfecting of the Caesar over a couple of years and different processes and whether you could eat a rig or not. The anchovy plate was one, and the chicken became one. Everything else just sort of mills about, and certainly the polenta. But she was very keen to create iconic dishes associated with the restaurant. And as I recall, she would never really wanted to be singled out as the chef of the restaurant per se. She always liked to work for the restaurant. She saw the restaurant as a totality.
Yes, and everything was treated as if, I mean, all the food items were treated as if they were, you know, as special as a truffle or foie gras. So the hamburger became what it is today because of the special care and the, you know, the process of, you know, the bringing in a chuck every day and stripping it and having the right amount of fat and salting it ahead of time and then grinding it in a special way. I mean, it all was treated. Everything was treated like precious jewels. And that's the one thing that is probably the most significant thing that she left with me personally, is that a strawberry is as divine as, you know, any highfalutin ingredient.
Any luxury ingredient.
Treated it as such and you didn't masquerade it, and if you could reveal its purity in that sense, that was an intellectual and artistic act.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kitchens just, they're doing so much that the actual essence of something gets lost in the methodologies.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me so ahead of its time, what she did. I mean, you talk about... It's funny. We had Kelly Fields from New Orleans on the show. What, John? You want to say something?
Ahead of its time. I think she created it.
Created
that. She was one of those people who helped create that idea about food. So ahead of its time, it's finally everybody does it now, or to some degree.
But when we say it, what are you referring to?
Well, how she uses ingredients... how there's so many people now working in a rustic, you know,
right.
medium.
Yeah.
But she defined it. She created it. She really brought it ahead of her time. Well, a little bit, but she created it. So she was sort of the nexus in America for this simple food being brought over from some of her mentors in France and Italy.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that I think it's what's so striking to me about it is that she was actually recognized for it. You know, like I had Kelly Fields on the show recently, pastry chef from New Orleans, right? And we spent like 20 minutes talking about it. I said, "What's your signature dish?" Chocolate chip cookie, right? That you mentioned taking years to perfect the Caesar. She spent 2.5 years making a different, at least one version of that cookie daily. Right? And so when you get it, it's just a chocolate chip cookie. And she says, but it's a pure expression of joy. I can still hear her saying that, right? But that's the kind of thing that just only recently, and it was funny, in the interview I said to her, that's great, and I get it, and that's, you know, it's the kind of thing that doesn't win awards. You get nominated, but you don't win them. And then she won the Beard Award this year. Not that I really care about the Beard Awards that much, but I was happy for her. But Judy was being celebrated for this stuff, you know, years ago. I think there is this thing that if it doesn't look complicated, if it doesn't play into like the sort of modernist movement, if it's not Instagrammable, if it's not, you know, it's in a lot of ways, at least from the outside, it's very egoless food, right? You said she was in service of the restaurant. I think she's really gave herself to just, as I understand it from outside, what's the ultimate expression of this dish, right? And that's the kind of thing that until very recently was really not appreciated the way, you know, more showy food is. You know, I make I point out the number of women in this country still who do very traditional rustic Italian food. You know, there, Amy Brandwine in D.C., Kathy Wims in Portland. You know, it goes on. And, Jody Williams in New York City, right? And until very recently, these things were just kind of taken for granted. You know, a lot of times it's where chefs go, you know, on their night off or after service, that they're very popular with food writers, but they're not the ones that get, like, the acclaim. But she did, and she got it so early. What do you think? Is that a function of being here in the Bay Area, where there was sort of a, people were sort of more appreciative and attuned to, well, what it, to the value of this food?
Maybe what John was saying, too, is she understood the that the restaurant as a whole was, that it was maybe more powerful than even her, and she was looking at it. I mean, that's something I still love about Zuni, and it's like you can see a businessman next to a transvestite, next to a, you know, it, like a person just graduating to a person that is retiring. I mean, it's very much like a place that everyone has come to love, and I think, I mean, going back to your other point, I think she just wasn't really into fussy food. In between jobs, I had left to go to probably a little more fancy of a restaurant, and I came back to just help, like, do a couple shifts at Zuni. And I remember, like, getting there early because I wanted to just, like, do stuff, and I was, like, just picking parsley, and because it was, like, one of the garnishes on my station, and she's like, why are you picking on that parsley? And I was like, I thought that you wanted the parsley picked. And she's like, no, just chop it all up. You know, and I think that, to me, was, like, she was so confident in her food and the way that she wanted it that a lot of the superfluous things that, like, you know, you kind of do in more fancy fine dining restaurants, she was not really, she just didn't see the point of it. If it didn't really, like, affect the flavor or, like, you know, it just didn't have anything to do with that kind of mentality of, like, I don't know.
That's there's a sort of sadism in certain restaurants. You know, I don't want to say what restaurant it was, but there's this great story. And I know it's true because the person who told me it was actually there. It wasn't, like, third hand. But in a very famous, very acclaimed restaurant in this country, somebody was working there. And there was they had a brunoise of green apple, and they stewed it down. And then it was going to get put through, like, a RoboCoop and then passed, right? And do you know where that one going? Anyway, the brunoise wasn't perfect. So the cook's, like, stewing whatever, and a sous chef comes along and puts the whole thing in the bin and says that brunoise wasn't perfect. And the new cook said, you know, it's going to get put through a food processor and, like, passed, like. And they said, doesn't matter. That's not how we do it here. Everyone could probably guess what restaurant this is. But but this is kind of what you're saying, right? Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And she would have, could be absolutely exacting about certain things, that would strike her as absurd.
Yes.
Right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was interested in a simple approach at how some of her mentors in Europe would have handled something.
Right.
Not overly picked on. Pretty simple, grab this, chop it up kind of loosely, hold it together, fold it, put it on there, and then get going.
Yeah. So you mentioned, go ahead, Nate, you want to say something?
I was just saying to your question of why Judy was able to get attention and acclaim for doing that food in such a simple way when a lot of other people, particularly women chefs, have not. I think one thing just speaks is really to her brilliance at doing it and her dedication to doing it. And there's a lot of hardworking chefs out there, no doubt. I mean, Zuni with Judy were the same thing. There wasn't, I mean, I didn't know Judy when, you know, John and Gail were there and when first coming on. But when I started there in 2004, I mean, there was no separating the two at all. She was there twice as long every week as I was.
Mm-hmm.
And she filled very little operational role. She wasn't there to make the X, Y, or Z. She was there to always make sure X, Y, and Z were just the way they needed to be.
Yeah.
And I she was particularly talented at doing it and gifted at doing it. I think the acclaim were really due to her brilliance.
Yeah. Can you
Yeah, I mean, we have to talk about this chicken for a minute, right? Because this dish is like, does everyone know the Zuni chicken? Does anyone not know the chicken? Okay.
The chicken?
Oh, of course. Canada, right. So it's well, go ahead. You'll do it better than me. First, what's the prep? But can you? I want to hear about the development because, you know, John just mentioned 2 years. 2 years of developing a Caesar, right? Now most people hear that and go, "How many ways could you tweak a Caesar?" Yeah. Right?
Well, the chicken had to be a particular weight, so it's a 2.8 pound chicken called a wog. And my God, if we had a 3.5 pound chicken come in, Jesus, you know, just screwed up the whole thing. It's just too damn big. I don't even know what size your chickens are now because can you even get them 2.8?
Between 2.5.
It's much more difficult, actually.
It's difficult because chickens are just grown so large. I mean, it's completely different. That was a huge thing. And the salt and pepper mix, you know, was a very particular ratio.
Salted for how long at the restaurant? I think in the cookbook it's 24 to 48 hours.
It's about 24 hours, 36 hours okay. tops, right?
So it's salted, it goes in the fridge.
And it's got garlic crushed under its skin and a little piece of thyme.
No longer. I think maybe 2005, 2006, Judy did away with all of the adornments except for salt and pepper, just the salt and pepper.
Fascinating. We still do that. We still put garlic and thyme up there. What? And then, you know, the wood oven was brand new, so we had to break it all in. And then, you know, firing them and having 14 or 15 or 16 in there was a big freaking deal.
And then the dressing, or the drippings, would then get incorporated into a dressing for a bread salad, right? Frisée, currants,
poured on top of the bread salad at some point during the serving portion. But working out the bread salad, I actually don't really remember it, although it was a really particular loaf of bread we had to get.
It was an Il Fornaio loaf.
Il Fornaio.
Very
specific. Are they still in business? They still bake bread?
Il Fornaio, I believe, is still in business, yeah.
So, yeah, she picked the large loaf, and it had a very fine crumb, and it had a dark crust. We could use a little bit of the crust, but never the bottom. And then sometimes the bread would differ, and, you know, we really couldn't use levain. But Il Fornaio, it had to be a white, fine crumb bread baked very specially in their ovens. So I don't know. I mean, it was a big deal.
And then the olive oil was a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, she's asking the company cook special, different way for Zuni Cafe.
A good story about Judy and the chicken and her exacting nature, and I may mix up some of the details here, but she was traveling to an event out of state and flying out of SFO, and they had salted chickens and packed them into coolers, luggage, and the airport they had to go on a scale to see, you know, see were they overweight and did they need to be charged extra. And at the airport, Judy realized that she had, I believe it was big chickens that were too bigger than normal based on the count in the cooler and the tear weight of the cooler and what it said. And she just did the math in her head, and she said, we undersalted the chickens. And she opened up the cooler, and she tasted a raw chicken at the airport and determined that she was right, like licked it. And then called the restaurant and said, all the chickens are under-seasoned. Weigh them. Check it. They all need more salt. And was going to come back to the restaurant to deal with it herself and somebody, I believe the current owner, Gilbert Pilgrim, I believe he talked her off that cliff of canceling her trip to come and sell chickens.
That sounds like Judy. What are some dishes at that restaurant? You know, there's the Caesar, you mentioned the anchovy plate. I think at the pot de creme, the chocolate pot de creme for dessert. What are some dishes, that you're particularly... that you think maybe aren't as well known, that are as much a part of the DNA of that restaurant, or that you just personally were very fond of either cooking or eating, that don't get the same kind of play in the history books?
Well, I think the flourless chocolate cake is straight out of Julia Child.
Literally, just like literally. Straight up. Nate's not.
Yeah, and I think that was more iconic and more well-known and beloved than the chocolate pot de creme.
Okay.
Yeah, the flourless chocolate cake and the espresso granita.
The espresso granita, yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah. Anything else? Anything you just really love?
We used to do a lot of fun things with those little Spanish crocks with rabbit and dough, and then a plate on top, make mm-hmm. a little dobier out of it. And we'd bake them, and they'd be all stacked up on sheet trays, going into ovens. And it was an ordeal.
Cause you remember?
These stupid...
The dobe?
Do you remember that? The dobes, the rabbit one was... We did often. There was back in the day when we were there, there was always a big cooking project, a braised thing, something working on. I think braised meats there were
When
big,
you say cooking project, you mean something that was being developed?
No, something that you'd have to get there and, you know, it'd probably been roasted overnight. I mean, we used to do white beans in flasks. So imagine you've got a Chianti flask and you've put a whole bunch of them in the fireplace at midnight and they're all got their white beans in them and they're cooking and you come in the morning and one of them broke, you know, because I would be in the morning. I was a lunch chef for a while, and then you'd have these flasks with these beans, and the beans had gotten so big during the cooking process that it was one bean at a time throughout the top of the flask. And so you'd have to shake the beans like this in the flask and get the beans to come out one by one to put them on a plate.
Yeah.
And they created the most amazing cooked bean you've ever had in your life, because it wasn't like putting it in a pressure cooker, because it was, well, did we put a cork in them? They were fantastic, but it was such a huge pain in the ass. Even getting the beans in the bottle was a pain in the ass. And we did these kinds of things
all the time
back in the day, just all of the time. The kitchen was kind of a train wreck back then. It's very beautiful now. But when we were there, it was, you know, it was goofy.
There was a dish that was not very successful, but we continued to do it. Did you guys remember the chartreuse? The tuna chartreuse?
Oh.
Larded with anchovy, with lettuce, and they were cooked in... You remember that? Big old...
What was the cut?
The cut was
the tuna.
The mid-sized tuna loin,
yeah.
Cooked very slowly with these... You know, with chartreuse and white wine and anchovies and lettuce. We had to cut it out of the crock.
With anchovy.
And put it on a plate and then adorn it with various sauces.
Cutting it out of
sauces.
The crock, we had to cook the thing right.
Well, we had to cook it first, but when we did it, six or seven or eight times.
Was that a classic dish that she...
It was put in a container like one of these casserole pans up here, pots.
One of these liquor
And you put huge chunks of tuna in there, and you wedged them all in, and you flavored it up with all this stuff. Then you put a lid on it, and you really cooked it slowly. Or you tried to. There was no sous vide in 1987. So you throw it in an oven. You got to get this damn thing done. And nine times out of ten, try as we might, it was very difficult to get that thing so it was medium rare all the way through and beautifully cooked. It was supposed to come out pink.
So
it's very complicated.
A couple of dishes I remember too.
Yeah.
Because there were really great cooks there, and one like my immediate manager, Ramey, he was doing a lot of charcuterie back then. So the stuff he was doing, the sausages, those would hit the menu, and those would be always really really exciting. And then Carol was, she was kind of the chef de cuisine at that time, and she was influenced by a lot of like Mexican flavors, and there was this sour orange like braised pork dish that I still remember with like smoked guajillo, and I don't know, it was delicious. So there's I think something that I remember about Zuni that doesn't get a lot of play is the pizza though. During lunch, and it's like the ricotta salata with the olive oil and like a little bit of oregano. It's really simple, but it's delicious.
So either we're almost out of time, but I want to ask either for Brendan, Gail, and John, right? And you two could give me different answers. Either a dish, a technique, something from that restaurant, one or two things that live in your restaurant now. It could be the most minor thing. What's the first one or two things maybe that come to mind? Whether it's an actual, you know, whether it's something that would be apparent to anyone other than you or not.
I mean, the first thing that I remember that I still have in my kitchen is a mortar and pestle, because, just making aioli, just pounding the garlic, you know. Adding the salt to it, all those little things that
she wasn't really big on machinery. So, you know, it's like these, like, one in a million spoon shapes that, you know, like, that you have to have. Or, you know, I think it's, I really like that about the Zuni Kitchen, and something that, you know, we try to make sure, even, you know, we use the mortar as much as we can at the restaurant, too.
Great. Thank you. Gail?
Olive oils. We have many different kinds of olive oils.
What's many?
11.
Wow.
They're all for something kind of special.
Everything, cooking, finishing, they all have a...
They do.
They don't probably, well, that number, you can't use each one in more than maybe two or three things at most.
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's great. That was practice at Zuni?
Yeah, we would do a lot of olive oil tasting.
Specific.
Oh, yeah.
We had a grocery store in the basement.
Yeah.
We had all these olive oils. They're very specific. And then even the anchovy plate, the olive oil is very specific. And each year, or every 4 months, you have to choose another one that had exactly the same profile because the one that they were using had gone rank or was no longer available or whatever. So she'd have to go through a constant tasting to keep that oil the same.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have anything. I think what we have is just sort of a collective gestalt of Zuni that we've brought forward. I mean, we left Zuni a long time ago, and so we took that knowledge with us to all of our consulting jobs and whatnot that we did for 7 years before we got to foreign cinema. So, and I do remember that when we got to Zuni, Judy removed all of the spices, and we were left with just coriander seed. Gone was the array of spices that the chef before had had, all in the staff meal.
It was Southwestern.
Mm-hmm. We had everything. And so when we were there, it was very pure. We had fresh herbs, coriander seed. I don't know of another dried spice we would have had. We didn't have cumin. She didn't have cumin until she went to Morocco, and I don't know when that was, in the mid-90s. So for us to go to other restaurants and try to cook, you know, we're like, ooh, geez, what is all this weird stuff?
Interesting.
It's very pure.
What's your favorite thing to prepare? Whether it's just butchering, whether it's one of the different sausages or bake, like what is your favorite thing to do in that kitchen?
My favorite thing is, I don't know, for working in a restaurant, it's very hard to say it's for favorite thing.
Yeah.
I like everything. But, you know, my thing is to do is, I like to almost like a Judy thing, you know, I think I do something, I want to create, I want to more salt or less salt. It's kind of like figuring out.
Being very precise.
Yeah, it depends what thing you do when you think in your head.
Yes.
And do it.
And make it happen. Yeah. I sense today when you showed me around that you're especially proud of butchering.
Yeah.
You showed me a whole lamb in the walk-in, and you very proudly told me how quickly you could take it apart.
Oh yes, absolutely.
It's Kwong's hand in the book, right? Like his hands in the Zuni book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
All the butchering stuff.
And even I saw how to chop the onion in there.
Yes. Probably. Yes. 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 It's in there.
That's my hand.
Okay, Nate, for you. Being, you know, I just, most chefs want to, you know, put their own imprint on what they're doing, right? You're the chef of the restaurant. We just spent an hour talking about the legacy of this place, certain things that are always there. How do you find a way to sort of make your own imprint known within that lane that you sort of have to stay in there?
I don't really think of myself as separate from the restaurant. I don't know if I would have put it in those terms prior to hearing Gail and John speak to it, but And Brandon, but in terms of putting my own imprint, I really see it as carrying on a legacy, and not specifically tied to Judy, although Judy is obviously an extremely important piece of Zuni Cafe. I think Zuni means a lot more to other people beyond Judy's imprint and the other chefs who've been there over the years. And Brandon referred to Carol and Ramey. And there were a lot of chefs who were really, you know, co-chefs of Judy or chefs of cuisines who were really influential. And I think for me, what I'm more driven is by what do our customers expect? What's going to keep them coming into the door? What goes with our chicken and pizza and hamburgers? Because I'm writing a menu every day with myself and the sous chefs, and we have our team executing it every day. I think to me, it's staying true to Judy's ideals and her approach, but not necessarily always digging into the, you know, the repertoire and saying, okay, well, we're going to do Judy circa 1989 today.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's probably best for everybody involved, right? Including the long-term sustainability of the restaurant. I mean, as a business.
Yeah, I think it wasn't something we've touched on, but I think when they're talking about, you know, Judy, you know, trying to figure out what are these dishes, these signature dishes that I'm going to build the restaurant around, those were part of her wanting to create that comfort food, that food she wanted to eat, but also to make a successful business. That chicken makes a successful business, and I can lose money on the quail that's delicious and we have people come and enjoy. We can, you know, we can have our wine prices particularly low because we've got other revenue makers that come in the restaurant. I think that was Judy, the business person.
I just want to thank you guys all again for being, you know, to me, I'm not in your business. I write about your business. I love your business. This is, you know, the way people find their way to jobs, the way those jobs lead to sort of how you develop as a chef in your own right, the way the stuff gets passed on. I mean, maybe there's other places where it's as strong. I can't think of a more powerful example than like this legacy that's like still very much alive, and the way it kind of like flows through all you guys and other people at the restaurant and people who've moved on from the restaurant. So thanks for being here and thanks for sharing it with us tonight.
Thank you.
And thank you all.
Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. Jody Liano, thank you for having me here.
Thank you for coming.
It was my pleasure. I was happy to be here. This is my third trip to California in 3 months. And
I'm glad we were
there's
the
not many people I would have done it for, but I was glad to be here. Congratulations on a great event. And how do people find the school if they want to find the school?
SFcooking.com.
SFcooking
on all social media.
And you'll see both you'll see everything that's on offer here. The various programs, the various one-offs, the various everything. Okay. To all of our guests, Priti Mistry. It's a bit of a tongue twister the way the second syllable of her first name, but it's not that I don't remember it. It's just I feel like I'm going to mess it up. Priti Mistry, thank you for doing the one-on-one. To Nate Norris, Kwong Wem, John Clark, Gail Peary, and Brandon Ju, thank you for being there to talk about your dear departed mentor. To Jeet Paul, thanks for editing these things together. As always, thank you again to the Hotel Carlton and to all of you out there in podcast land. Thank you for listening. If you feel like it, please give us a rating. Who was your friend who came last night? Who was the pastry chef at Quince?
And Jen Felton.
Jen Felton came up to me, told me how much she likes the show, and then said she kind of looked down at her shoes and said, I haven't rated you yet. That happens all the time. Can you guys please rate the show? It doesn't cost anything to listen to the damn show. Just rate it. Take you 2 seconds. Anyway, that's my rant. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrationing happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.